In the mid-1990s, Good Samaritan Hospital was closed on the west side of Milwaukee, which added to the blight in an area that was already marked by poverty, unemployment, addiction, and crime. Then in the year 2000, Aurora Healthcare transferred 321,000 square feet of hospital buildings and two city blocks of land to the newly incorporated nonprofit organization now known as City on a Hill. That's when Nehemiah became one of my favorite books of the Bible, because we were in a rebuilding mode. And God used that book to call me to City on a Hill. He gave me a picture of the city of Milwaukee that looked just like the report Nehemiah heard from his brother about a city with its walls torn down, people unprotected from their enemies and in despair. Then God gave me an assignment that was a lot like Nehemiah's assignment to change our city. I was afraid of failing, but I really just took one step at a time, following God's lead, and we started rebuilding the lives of children and families. And now, 18 years later, instead of seeing young people die of gun violence or drug overdose in our neighborhood, I get to watch them find Christ, graduate from high school, get jobs, and go on to college with scholarships. I see families growing stronger and people being healed and crime statistics come down. I found out you don't need a name like Nehemiah to rebuild things for God's glory. You just need some compassion and enough courage to take that first step of faith. My name is Diane, and God is rebuilding our city.
God is looking for people to rebuild. Let me start off with this. Those of you who consider yourself the best of the best, you are the brightest one in the room, you are the head cheerleader, you are the star athlete, I want you to know that God can even use a person like you. He can, it's true. It's just like God tends to use ordinary people, and that's really the foundation of our story today. Who is Nehemiah? Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king, King Artaxerxes. What is a cupbearer, you might say? Well, he was not a builder, he was not an architect, he was not a priest. He had the job of tasting the wine before the cup was given to the king. And the reason they did this, in case someone would try to poison the king, he would die instead. And so this was a cool job if you like wine, unless someone tries to poison the king and then you die and it's a bad job. So you should know that up front. So Nehemiah is just an ordinary guy. God raises him up. He sees something that bothers him deeply. And so we're going to look at this story, Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. It's towards the beginning of the scriptures. If you have your Bible app, you can click on NEH. It says, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hechaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, are in great trouble and disgrace. The walls of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So just to refresh, the walls of Jerusalem, they have been down for 140 years. This is a tremendous embarrassment to the people of God, and it left them very vulnerable to outside attacks. And just to put this in context, imagine that Milwaukee in the late 1800s was ravished by tornadoes, and here we are in 2018 and things have still not been rebuilt. And so the people of God, they are depressed. They feel like there's no hope. They thought life is never, ever going to be better. The walls of our city are broken down. The whole nation is distraught until one man, a cupbearer, a mixologist, an ordinary guy, he has a divine moment. Somebody has got to do something about this, and it might as well be me. That's what Nehemiah is going to do. He's going to look at the broken walls. He's going to look at the condition of his people, and he's going to have a divine discontent. I can't stand to watch this. Somebody has to do something about it. It might as well be me. And I want to show you three principles of people that God chooses to use to rebuild. Ordinary rebuilders. Who are they? Well, first of all, they are people who sit down to cry. This is what Nehemiah did in verse 4. It says, "When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept." He did the very same thing that Jesus did when he approached Jerusalem and he saw they had turned the temple into a marketplace. Jesus, he was overwhelmed with emotion. He broke down and he cried. He looked at the people and said, "They are without a spiritual leader. They are sheep without a shepherd." He was just overwhelmed with emotion and cried. And this was not just a sniff, sniff, boo, hoo, hoo. This is ugly cry. You know what I'm talking about? You're wearing makeup. The nose starts running. There's no Kleenex anywhere around. There is nothing pretty about this. Ugly cry. Nehemiah, he couldn't even stand up. He was so overwhelmed with emotion, so he sat down, he sobbed and sobbed, not for himself, but for someone else. And what's interesting is that Jerusalem was 1,000 miles away from where he was at. And so it would have been so easy to do what I've done many times, to say, you know what, that is just nowhere near me. That doesn't affect me. Nehemiah, he was living in his palace, he was comfortable. It would have been easy for him to think, oh man, my heart goes out to them. Maybe I'll write a check. Maybe I will pray from here, but not really let that burden sink into our hearts. I don't know about you, but I've become skilled at ducking pain. You know, I know that there's going to be nothing good on the news, so I'm not going to watch the news. I know they're probably going through a hard time, but man, I just got too much on my plate. Nehemiah, though, he opened up his heart and he said, you know what? This is not okay with me. And so I just want to ask you at the offset, what is it that breaks your heart? What about it in this world that breaks your heart on the behalf of God? What is it that God dislikes and he's given you that burden? And you say, God, break my heart for the things that break yours. What breaks your heart? Maybe you hear someone, they're struggling financially, and you say, man, that's just not right. I could help. People who are mistreated or devalued, or maybe it's trafficking that's happening. Somebody has got to do something about it, and it may as well be me. I want to encourage you to open up your heart. Don't appease it. Don't ignore the burden, but open up your heart and let it in. There will be many of you who will say, why doesn't everyone care about this the way that I care about this? Am I the only one who cares? Let me tell you why you feel that way. Because God has chosen you. God gave that burden uniquely to you. You didn't choose the burden chose you. It seeps within your soul. And if you open up your heart, God can turn that misery into a ministry. God can take something that bothers you and you look and say, somebody has got to do something about this, and it may as well be me. This is where vision comes from. Who does God use to rebuild? He uses those who sit down and they cry. But secondly, God uses those who kneel down and pray. Watch what Nehemiah does. As soon as he is finished with crying, it says, verse 4, "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." All sorts of people would say, that's too big of a problem. That's too big of a need. I'm just one person. We're just one small little family. What can we do? Let me tell you what you can do. You can pray. You can pray to the God of heaven. Every single time, you plus God equals a majority. All the power of God, whatever Nehemiah did, he preceded it in prayer. 12 instances in his story, we see that he prayed. The whole rest of chapter 1 is this powerful prayer. God raised up a great leader who was a praying leader. The strongest leaders will be praying leaders. And through his prayerful leadership, something that should have taken years took less than 8 weeks. I want you to catch that. Nehemiah spends more time praying than he does building. He spent 4 months praying. He spent 52 days building the wall. So who does God use? He uses those who sit down and they weep, who they kneel and they pray, and finally they stand up and they act. After spending a significant amount of time in prayer, Nehemiah just doesn't sit around and keep having prayer meetings, but he goes to King Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, and he says, "I need your help. I've already checked out what needs to be done. I just need you to sign the purchase order." And so this is Nehemiah chapter 2 now, verse 1. It says, "In the month of Nisan," this is not the month of Toyota, "in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, 'Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart.' I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?' The king said to me, 'What is it you want?' Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, 'If it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it.'" What is that last part? "So that I can rebuild it." I'm not going to start a hashtag. I'm not going to send up a GoFundMe page. I'm not going to sit around and complain, "Why doesn't anyone care and do something about this?" Because the God of heaven has given me a burden. And my ministry has come from my misery, and I'm looking at this and I'm saying, "I'm not okay with this. Someone needs to do something, and it may as well be me." Some of you are going to catch this. God's going to take that burden on you, and he's going to turn it into a vision. Things are going to be different because you said, "No, no, no, not on my watch. This is not okay with me." All those voices inside of you that say, "You're not enough, you don't know enough." No, I am just an ordinary person who God has called to do something extraordinary, and me plus God always equals the majority. It might as well be me. In 2 days, we're going to remember September 11th once again. How many of you remember exactly where you were when you heard the news? There were 4 planes that were flown on that day. 2 of the planes were flown into the World Trade Center. 1 was flown into the Pentagon. And 1 never reached its intended target. That was United Flight 93. On that plane, there was a 32-year-old dad. And he got on the phone and he called down to the ground to the operator. And he asked, "What is going on?" And she said, "They're flying planes into buildings, and they're planning to take your plane and kill thousands of more people." So this 32-year-old dad, his name was Todd Beamer, said, "Somebody has got to do something about this. It may as well be me." And this dad, he had 2 young children and a 3rd one on the way. He led all the passengers, 32 of them, in prayer. He led the Lord's Prayer, and then he said the now famous words, "Let's roll." And that ordinary guy became a hero. He saved thousands of lives. He took the plane down in that field in Pennsylvania because one ordinary guy said, "Someone needs to do something about this. I'm not going to let thousands of people die. Let's roll." To make a difference in this world, you don't have to be the best. You just need to care more than the rest. And you and I, we will never change a life. We will never rebuild a city until people know that we care. To make a huge difference in this world, you don't need to be the best. You don't need to be the one that everyone says, "Oh, they will be the one that God uses. You can be an ordinary cupbearer who just happens to care more and one day says, someone has to do something about this, and it may as well be me. Now, earlier we talked about how Nehemiah, he was a man of prayer. It's interesting, Nehemiah never prayed to God, would you rebuild the wall? He prays that God would give him an opportunity to rebuild. And this is the difference between a visionary and a dreamer. Dreamers dream about things being different. Visionaries, they envision themselves making the difference. Dreamers think about how nice it would be for someone to do something. Visionaries look for the opportunity to do something. Nehemiah, he was a man with a vision, not with a dream. He was expecting God to work through him, not for God to do all of the work. He was looking for an opportunity to work alongside of God, and God gives him the opportunity. Nehemiah, I think, is a great example for us of how prayer and planning go hand in hand. I think so often we can go to one extreme or the other. We go all spiritual, and it's all prayer meetings, and yet then we never execute the plan. And some of the rest of us, we're on the other side. It's all about strategy. It's all about the planning. And then when things succeed, we take all the credit for ourselves and never take it into account what God has done. There were three hikers going through the woods, and one day they reached a raging, violent river, far too large to cross. And so the first hiker, he prays, God, would you give me the strength to get across this river? And all of a sudden, man, God answers this prayer, like huge biceps are growing on him, like his legs are getting bigger. This is a true story, by the way. So he jumps in the river and he's able to swim across it in 2 hours. Now, hiker number two, he's watching this and he says, God, would you give me the strength and would you give me the tools to get across this river? And so biceps start growing on him. But all of a sudden, a canoe drops down. And so he canoes across the river. He capsizes twice, but he gets across in an hour. The third hiker prays, God, would you give me the strength? Would you give me the tools? And would you give me the intelligence to cross the river? And he turns into a woman. Who then pulls out the map, walks a few hundred yards down the river, crosses the bridge that was there. You see, it's the spiritual, it's the practical, they go together. And so I want to just lay out to you, these are the steps that Nehemiah laid out, his plan. Step one, convince the king to allow me to leave his service in order to rebuild the wall around the city. Step two, I need to convince the king to lend financial support. Step three, get letters from the kings to the governors in the surrounding area to provide me safe passage. Step four, work out a deal with Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, to get enough lumber to build the city gates and a house for my own. Step five, ask the king for the title of governor of Judah. Step six, organize and equip the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Step seven, start rebuilding. So don't overlook the starting blocks of planning and prayer when you rebuild. When God gave Nehemiah the vision to cast his vision before the king, he was ready. There would be no doubt in Artaxerxes' mind that this man was serious. This was not some pipe dream. And if given the opportunity, Nehemiah was prepared to follow through. So have you been praying? Have you been planning? If God sent the right opportunity to you, would you be able to take care of it? If God finally sent that friend that you have been praying for so long and they ask you, hey, why do you have the faith that you do? Why are you able to handle the troubles of life and it doesn't blow you up? Would you know how to point them to God in that time. There will be opportunities that God sends your way, and if you have not been praying or planning, those opportunities become missed opportunities. Now back to our story, Nehemiah 2:11. King Artaxerxes, he's released Nehemiah to the vision of rebuilding the city walls. Think about how exciting this must have been for Nehemiah. It's all coming into reality. And so verse 11, he travels to Jerusalem. It says, I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few others. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. In all likelihood, this is the very first time that Nehemiah has set foot on his native soil. And when he first heard of the condition of Jerusalem, he wept. And no doubt now, as he finally steps foot in the city, he weeps once again. Nehemiah's arrival would not have gone unnoticed. It wasn't every day that a Persian official visited the city with an armed escort. And besides that, what's with all the lumber? And so surely he is the talk of the town. Everyone is wondering what he's up to. And yet Nehemiah does not share his vision with anyone for at least 3 days. If I have a good idea, I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut for 3 minutes. But Nehemiah, he knew that it was too soon to share his intentions. Instead, he needed to take inventory of the situation. Verse 13, by night I went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate, this is prime real estate, examining the walls of Jerusalem which had been broken down and its gates which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. So Nehemiah, he teaches us a very important lesson here. When God lays a vision on your heart, don't tell anyone. For starters, no one else is going to be nearly as excited as you are, and their lack of zeal might prevent you from getting it started at all. Don't prematurely share the vision. Do the background work. Do some fact-finding. Ask the hard questions. Know what you're up against. Nehemiah, his midnight ride through the city wasn't fueled by a lack of faith. He investigated because he was committed to the project, and he wanted to understand the magnitude of the project. And so after he does his work, he does his investigation and prayer, it is now time to share the vision with the residents of Jerusalem. Verse 17, then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. And I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So Nehemiah, his speech here has four components of sharing the vision. He shares the problem in verse 17. He says, we are in trouble. Jerusalem lies in ruins. The gates have been burned. He shares then the solution. Come. Let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He shares the reason why something must be done. He says, let us rebuild so that we will no longer be in disgrace. And he shares why something must be done now, not later. He explains the sense of urgency. He says, I told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. Nehemiah says, now is the time to act because you'll never believe it. The king has given us favor. He's supplying all the resources. God is at work, and we need to get in where God is working. Now let's go to Nehemiah chapter 3. And I want to warn some of you in advance because this chapter has the potential to be boring. There's a lot of names. It's a little bit like the credits at the end of the movie. They roll really fast and you don't care unless you were in the movie. But all scripture is inspired. It's here for a reason. Verse 1. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hanel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining sections, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hassanah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakaz, repaired the next section. Next to him, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs, and next to him, Zadok, the son of Bana, also made repairs. So the phrase, next to him, after him, are mentioned 28 times in this chapter. And what does that mean? It means that they worked together. These are different types of people. These are not builders. These are not construction workers. I admire people who can build things. I admire so much people who can remodel and do repairs. That is not me. If you see me in Home Depot, call my mom or Joni. I am lost. A few years ago, I hung a lighting fixture in our foyer. It's kind of high up. And now that we have little girls, they like playing underneath it. And I'm always like, can you just shift over about 3 feet? I'm pretty sure that thing's crashing down any day. These were not construction people. It says that they were goldsmiths, people who make perfume in verse 8. There were merchants in verse 32. And so you have all sorts of people, men and women, young and old, all sorts of occupations, and they all needed to participate to get the job done. They left their jobs behind. They left their farms, their ranches. There was sacrifice to get the job done. And it's the very same truth for the church. The church is a family. The church is an army when we're assembled and we're compared to the body of Christ. Every one of us has a part to play. Ephesians 4:16 says, Christ has put each part of the church in its right place. Each part helps the other parts. This is what is needed to keep the whole body together. In this way, the whole body grows strong in love. We are all needed, and we all fit together perfectly. B.C. Forbes, founder of Forbes magazine, he said, this is how you spell success. TEAMWORK. If we want to get something done for God, we do it together. Coming together is a beginning. Being together is progress. Thinking together is unity. Working together is success. And in Nehemiah chapter 3, you see this phrase over and over again, next to him, after him. Everyone has a role to play. Every one of us that's a follower of Christ, we have a spiritual gift that has been given to us. How many of you would say, I know what my spiritual gift is? Okay. How many of you would say, I don't know what my spiritual gift is? And how many of you would say, I don't know what a spiritual gift is? So here's the list found in Romans 12, verse 4. Just as our bodies have many parts and each part has a special function, so it is with Christ's body. We are many parts of one body and we all belong to each other. In his grace, God has given us different gifts for doing certain things well. So if God has given you the ability to prophesy, speak out with as much faith as God has given you. If your gift is serving others, serve them well. If you are a teacher, teach well. If your gift is to encourage others, be encouraging. If it is giving, give generously. If God has given you leadership ability, take the responsibility seriously. And if you have a gift for showing kindness to others, do it gladly. I love that one of these gifts is the gift of encouragement. I love people who have this gift. I think some people think that it's a spiritual gift to have discouragement. That spiritual gift does not exist. Or I believe that God has given to me the spiritual gift of criticism. Discernment. No, criticism is not a spiritual gift. And so each of us, we come together as a family and we bring our gifts. We're supposed to worship together as a family. That's why we're in this room today. We should all sing. Some of you would say, I don't like singing. I don't have a very good voice. That doesn't stop the vast majority of us, right? That's why we keep turning up the volume. Psalm 63, verse 3 says, because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. When's the last time that you lifted up your name to God, your hands to God? Oh, I don't feel like lifting my hands. It's an act of surrender. A lot of times when we do the right thing, the emotions catch up later. But if you're waiting to feel prompted, waiting to feel emotions, then you won't do a lot of things. Job, he worshiped God after receiving the worst news that any of us could receive, that all his children had died. And yet he worships God. He brings the sacrifice of praise. When we come together as a family, that we should all give. We should all bring something. Now, lots of us were choosing to give online. I kind of like this t-shirt I found. There we go. That would look nice with a, you know, jacket. 2 Corinthians 9:7 says, each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Some will say, well, I can't give cheerfully, so I won't give at all. I think that's not the point of the passage. It's not about whether you should give, but it's about how much you should give. And if you're not cheerful about giving, then we ask God, God, would you change my heart? It's a blessing to be able to support the work of God. Some of us, we can give more. Some of us can give less. But we all give. We give that 10% to God, and then we pray about our offerings. Everyone has a role to play. In the story of Nehemiah, not everyone worked on rebuilding the walls. So Nehemiah 3:5, it says, the next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. And so here we see some people did the work, others did not. There will be lots of people happy to share in the victory, not as many people willing to work the battle and to do the work behind the scenes. And now 3,000 years later, we know who did the work and who did not. And there will always be participants and there will be spectators when it comes to the work of God. Participators, they come, they engage in worship, they listen to the message, they give in the offering, they plan out their week so that they can serve. Spectators, they expect other people to serve them. They come in late. They leave early. Participators, spectators, you may ask, well, how do I know which one am I? If in the last 5 minutes I've irritated you, you're a spectator. If you have been challenged and you'd say, you know what, I want my life to be a part of something bigger than me, you're a participant. You know, I love the story in verse 20 here. It says, next to him, Baruch, son of Zabbai, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the entrance of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. Notice, he did the work zealously. He did it with enthusiasm. He did it with diligence. He didn't just do his job. He did it with passion. When you have a vision of what God is doing and that God is rebuilding a city and he's rebuilding lives, it gives you passion to do the work. So I'm just here to encourage you today, if you are a teacher, you are rebuilding lives. If you're a parent, you're building or you're rebuilding. God is using you. If you're a police officer, if you're a public servant, you are rebuilding a city. If you work in a hospital, you're rebuilding lives. If you're an usher, if you're a greeter this morning, you're the first line. You're rebuilding hope. Don't ever lose sight of why you're doing what you're doing. God has called you. You are rebuilding. And so we're just going to close in prayer in just one moment, but I need a few people to come up on the stage with me. Joel. Joel, are you here this morning? All right. Next, Anne. Anne, would you be willing to come up on stage? Gabriella, would you be willing to come up here? You, young man, can you join us on the stage here? Right here. You get to play with Legos afterwards. Okay. We'll be good here. Okay, come on up. I want you to stand. Okay, Joel, can you stand right next to Anne here? I need, okay, come on up. Yes. So, these are all different people. And they all have different gifts that they bring. And yet God, in his tremendous wisdom, he has assembled us all together. Now, you know, if Joel is saying, you know what, my part of the wall, man, is fortified, it is strong, but Caleb, Cameron, you're falling asleep on me, you're not watching your section of the wall. We are only as strong as the weakest section of the wall is. And so we all bring our part, we all bring our gifts, and together we make one wall. We're rebuilding walls of faithfulness in families. We are rebuilding walls of righteousness in this city. We're rebuilding walls of hope. And I believe that God has spoken to people this morning. He's laid a holy discontent in your life. There's something that bothers you. You say, that is not right. And God has uniquely given it to you. And he's going to make that a vision. He's going to give you a purpose in your life. There's something that you need to do with that. And so if you want to be like Nehemiah today, I'm just going to ask you to stand right where you're at. You're not going to come to this altar, but I want you to stand. And we're going to pray that God would anoint you and use you today.